Looking at our world from a theological perspective. This is the Theology Central Podcast, making theology central.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is Sunday, November the 14th, 2021. It is currently 3:09 p.m. Central Time, and you know where I am. I'm here in the empty sanctuary of Victory Baptist Church. And you know where Victory Baptist Church is located, in the middle of nowhere, Texas. Thank you so much for tuning in, and welcome to another week of Bible study, another week of Bible study exercise. I really like to stress that idea, exercise. It's not for you just to listen to, it's for you to stand up, grab a Bible, grab a notebook, grab a pencil, because you are supposed to be not just a listener, but a participant. You're not supposed to be watching other people exercise. You're not supposed to simply be watching or listening to the exercise someone else has done. You are to be actively engaged in it. That is the goal of the Bible study exercise series. It's to move you from a passive listener to an active participant. I know I say that all the time. I don't know if anyone takes me actually serious when I say it, but I challenge you. I plead with you. I beg you. If I had the money, I would pay you. Grab a notebook, a pencil, a Bible, reference tools, and actually engage in the study. Look things up. Do the assignments that I give you. Participate, 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 because I continue to say this. It's needed more than ever. I truly mean this. I cannot say more than any time in the history of Christianity, but I will put it up there in the top two or three that right now is the time that it is more needed than ever that Christians actually get back to studying the Bible in a meaningful and in-depth way. They turn off all of the noise, all of the craziness, all of the conspiracy theories, all of the political hijacking of the church, and just open up the Word of God and dig in and dig deep, asking hard questions, struggling with the text, trying to find out the truth, trying to find out how it's applicable today. What did it mean in its context? Using correct hermeneutics, using correct Bible study skills. It's so important that you engage. So please, please, please participate. And if you have been participating, welcome to a brand new week. If you are brand new to the Bible study exercise, well, it took you long enough, but welcome, okay? You may be way behind, but just jump in right here. You don't need to go back. You can just move forward if you want to. Welcome. And remember, there is curriculum that is available to you. Go to theologycentral.net. Go to the blog section. You're going to have to scroll for a few minutes. Find the blog article entitled Daily Discipleship Guide. You click the link, you sign up at ministrygrid.com, and you have access to all of the curriculum. And we'll be referencing the curriculum for this week in just a few minutes. So please participate. If you know anyone else out there who really wants to study the Bible, invite them to participate, join in with you. You can hold each other, you know, accountable. You can ensure that each person is doing the study. You can share what you're learning with the other person. And just, you know, let's build a strong group of individuals who are hungry to learn God's word, and hopefully not only hungry to learn God's word, willing to be, I hate to say it, bold enough, because I guess in some Christian circles, you're really not to do this, to ask the tough questions, to struggle with the things the text presents to us. Not just to, oh, you know, just to go right past it, to overlook the issues, because the Bible just is filled with lots of difficult questions. In fact, the text that we'll be looking at this week, it's not a pleasant story. It's far uglier than the Christians pretend that it is. It's not pretty. It's ugly. I don't like it. And I think many people in our culture would be shocked that it's there, but it is there, and we have to deal with the ugliness of it. And in some ways, the fact that it's ugly, I think, will be very beneficial for this week's study. So before I introduce the text before I do anything. Now, if you have access to the curriculum, you can go ahead and have the Ministry Grid app or the Ministry Grid website open. I'll tell you which curriculum to be looking at here shortly. We'll be in the Adult Personal Study Guide, and I'm going to have you look at it here in a minute because I want you to see how they introduce it, which I think, well, I won't go into everything right now. It should be a good week of study. I think last week ended not great, but it ended, well, it just, I mean, that's the thing. Bible study, it always has its ebbs and flows depending on what you're doing. Sometimes this, well, I think that's the goal here with the Bible study exercise. It's to be very real and very organic, not to come across all polished and edited. It's supposed to be very real people studying the Bible. And some weeks it works out a certain way. Some weeks there's struggles. And I like that we never know what's going to happen. I like that. If it's all polished and rehearsed and edited, no. I like it to be, we're real people studying the Bible. And whatever happens, happens, okay? I really want it to feel that way. Because if I'm just going to copy any other podcast out there, what's the point? I mean, they already exist. So I don't want to be them. I want to be me. And this is the way that we have moved forward. I could do an entire podcast about my philosophy. Sometimes I feel like I need to just like do that podcast episode and just save it like at the top of everything so that everyone will understand my philosophy, because I think some people get it and some people don't. But I hope you're ready. All right. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write this down. All right. Now, again, the expectation is you're taking notes. I want you to write down more. I guess I'm going to place this as a question. And you can write it down as a question to yourself. You can place your name in the question if you need to. You can say, do I, but do you, do us, do we, what, however you want to phrase it, do you, I need to speak to myself as well, but do you have a theology of failure? Do you have a theology of failure? And do you believe that in many cases, Christians lack a true theology of failure? Do you have a theology of failure? And do you think that Christians in general lack a theology of failure? What do I mean by a theology of failure? I want you to really think about this, right? So, do you have a theology of failure? And do you think Christians lack a theology of failure? You may have never given this much thought, but I believe that if you look through the history of the church, Christianity seems to be really good at saying, okay, if you've made all kinds of mistakes before you're saved, hey, that's okay. Believe in Jesus. It's all gone. It's removed as far as the East is from the West. Now, once you become a Christian, the expectation is, in fact, this is just straight up taught, now that you are a Christian, you're a new creature, the old is gone, everything is new. They speak of that not in a positional way, but in a practical way. That is true of you are practical. You're now, that's true of you practically. You're now more than a conqueror. And so the expectation is now you're going to be holy, be godly, live godly. And then when some epic failure occurs, some massive sin occurs, in many cases, the church either acts shocked and or we handle ourselves in a very ungodly way that in many cases leads to more pain and suffering than it does good. It doesn't lead to reconciliation. It doesn't lead to restoration. It leads to shame and discouragement and depression and defection, I think, in many cases. Now, you may disagree with me. That's the whole joy of spending a week on one passage of scripture and one subject, because we really get a time to kind of discuss this and bounce the ideas around. But I believe, in my own personal opinion, is that many Christians lack a true theology of failure. It's like, no, that now that I'm a Christian, I will not fail. I'm going to be godly and I'm going to live godly. And now they will accept, which is weird, when they say that I'm going to live godly, they do accept small failures, right? You can, there's a lot of sins you can commit that no one's really going to call you out on. Everybody's going to say, well, nobody's perfect. But then there's certain sins There are certain sins that those are the anathema sins. Those are the mortal sins. If you commit that, then everybody's like, oh no. Okay. We've got to brand them with the scarlet letter, and they've got to be exiled to a place that no one's ever heard of before. Because I don't think in some cases Christians have a good theology of failure. And I think the church is lacking one. And I really believe we need to give this serious thought. Do we have a true theology of failure? Do we have it? Do you have it? Do I have it? And does the church at large, is it lacking a theology of failure? How have you seen churches handle failure? And why did they handle, and this is a very important one, why did they handle that failure in the way you witnessed? But there were other failures and other sins that were present within the church that didn't get the same attention. That didn't get handled anywhere close to the same way. Why do some sins reach like, uh-oh, dun, 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 this is bad. And all the other ones are like, okay, all right, it's okay. No one's perfect. It's really seems very inconsistent at times. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And the way the text behind what we're going to be discussing is going to be Genesis chapter 16, Genesis 16, verses 1 through 6. Genesis 16, 1 through 6. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to look at some textual things I want you to consider. This is the introduction. Now, remember, I do some of the teaching. I leave a lot of it for you. So you get out of this what you put into it. Sometimes I feel like I'll go back and listen to some of them. And I'm like, man, I probably should have done this and I should have done this. But then I'm thinking, no, that it's literally left there for them to do so. So if they didn't do it, then they didn't do it. Sometimes I'll go back and listen. Man, I should have just done that. I should have done it. But if I do that, then I'm falling into the trap of this just being another Bible study podcast where I do the teaching for you. So you listen to my study and you're not actually studying. So I've got to stop myself from doing that. There's times I feel I should, and there's times I think I make the right decision. You can always tell me if I'm right or wrong, but here we go. All right, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at some textual things I want you to see. Then we're going to go to the curriculum. I want you to see how they introduce it. And then I want you to look at some truths about what actually happened in this text that may make you very uncomfortable. All right, we're going to look at some textual issues. Then we're going to look at the curriculum. And then we're going to look at some uncomfortable facts. I think that's the way we're going to do so. All right. Are you ready? First thing I want us to do. I know this week is Genesis 16. I know it's 1 through 6. But I want you to see Genesis 16, 1 through 6 in light of the text of Scripture we studied last week. The reason we spent so much time, we're going to spend a week anyway, so I can't say the reason we spent an entire week on it is what the curriculum calls for, but the reason the curriculum wanted you to spend so much time in Genesis 15, and then this week immediately jumps to Genesis 16, is I think by seeing Genesis 16 in light of what we spent our time studying last week in Genesis 15, it really makes it a little bit more shocking. And maybe we need to be shocked a little bit here. Maybe we need to be slapped in the face a little bit to see the ugliness of it. Because I think we have a way of just kind of smoothing it out where it doesn't feel so horrific, but it's not really a good thing. All right, so here we go. Genesis chapter 15. Now, in Genesis chapter 15, verse 1, we read these words. After these things, after what things? We had the battle of the kings. We have Abram rescuing Lot. We have Melchizedek showing up. And we have the king of Sodom offering Abram a lot of materialistic possessions, materialistic wealth. And Abram refuses, turns it down and says, nope, you're not going to go around saying you made me rich. After all of that happens, after these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram. So after all of that happens, God reveals something to Abram. And you know what he revealed. He revealed three things. Number one, he revealed to Abram, you do not need to fear. Fear not. Now, that directly relates to the Battle of the Kings in Genesis 14, 1 through 11. As we've been talking about, I'm gonna continue to remind you of this because I think it's so important, seeing how it's all structured. Genesis 14, 1 through 11, you got basically war going on. And so God says, hey, don't fear. Don't fear. You have nothing to fear. I've got this all under control. Do not fear. Now, Abram had rescued Lot. That can make Abram a target. So God tells Abram, I'm your shield. Don't fear. I'm here to protect you. And then he tells Abram, I am your exceeding great reward. I am your exceeding great reward. No matter what you have, what you don't have, no matter what you're going through, look to me. I am your great reward. And I believe those three things are directly then linked to us by Genesis 15, 6, where we learn the doctrine of imputation, where Abram believed and God accredited to him as righteousness. The righteousness of God was given to Abram by faith. Because of the doctrine of imputation, because now I have the righteousness of Christ imputed to my account, I have nothing to fear. God becomes his righteousness, in a sense, he becomes my shield and he becomes my exceeding great reward. And we really drove that point home about God being our exceeding great reward and that we should be satisfied and our satisfaction should come from God alone. See how I did? I was able to say the word today, satisfaction. Isn't that amazing? Okay. I know sanctification, satisfaction, salsa. Okay. If you missed the last Bible study, yeah, because I have some neurological issues related to a seizure disorder. The other day I had some serious problems and was finding it difficult to say anything. I was finding it difficult to speak, period. But yeah, and for some reason, words that started with an S was just beyond my ability to speak them. I do not know what happened. It was weird, even when, well, I won't go through all of that again. All right. But again, Bible study happens in real life. So in some ways, I'm kind of glad that it happened because I want you to demonstrate that no matter what's going on in your life, good or bad, we always have to make time for Bible study. And sometimes those Bible studies that happen when things are not going well, they're still beneficial and they're still very important. So, but I want you to see everything right here. God gives him these amazing truths. Don't fear. I am your shield and I'm your exceeding great reward. Immediately, Abram says, well, what are you going to give me? Which is just absolutely amazing because he's like, you know, where's my heir? Where is this going to happen? And Abram said in verse 3, 15:3, Abram said, behold, to me, thou hast not given no seed. And lo, one born in my house is mine heir. What are you going, what's happening here? There's been promises that, you know, my seed is going to be so numerous and, you know, there's an entire nation that's going to rise from me and I don't even have a child yet. What is going on? And you can understand Abram's a little bit confused, but it seems shocking that he would immediately go there after being told these wonderful truths of don't fear, I'm your shield and I'm your exceeding great reward. It's almost like, oh, you're my exceeding great reward? Well, wonderful. What are you going to give me? Which completely misses the point. No, Abram, God is your exceeding great reward. Abram wasn't worried about God. He wanted what God was going to give him instead of focusing on God, which is really the essence of all of our problems. But then God repeats the promise to him. Genesis 15, verse 4. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, this shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now towards heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto them, so shall thy seed be. Hey, Abram, I'm going to take care of all of it, right? This is how your seed is going to be like all the stars in the heavens, if you can even number them. It's going to be large. It's going to be so many. I've got it under control. So God gives him all these words of comfort, these words of encouragement, these words of promise. It's such a beautiful and amazing picture. And then what is so shocking is when you just leave it right there and you jump to chapter 16. Because in light of all of these words of encouragement, in light of all these words of promise, after this beautiful picture that Abram believed and it was counted to him as righteousness, after seeing such an amazing scene that you're like, wow, this is so awesome. This is so beautiful. God is so great. This is awesome. Abram believed. This is wonderful. And then think of it this way. We go to this theological mountain of just beautiful truth and revelation in Genesis 15. And we quickly, in fact, this is what it feels like. We're on top of this theological mountain in Genesis 15. And we turn our Bibles to Genesis 16, and we just walk right off the side of that theological mountain, and we go crashing down to boom, we hit the reality of life. Theological mountaintop, walk right off the cliff, boom. And hopefully I didn't scare you, blow out your eardrums. I apologize. But boom, we go crash into the reality of life. Genesis 15, theological mountaintop. Genesis 16, the ugliness of life, the reality of life. And we constantly struggle with the theological reality of things that we believe, things that we may know, versus how we actually live. There's always inconsistency there. If you listen to our study on the doctrine of repentance this morning at Victory Baptist Church under the VBC podcast, you'll hear that we did a lot of discussion about this. Genesis 16, here we go. You ready? Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. And she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. Now, in Genesis 15, if we go verses 12 to 21, which is just, you talk about, that's not even a theological mountaintop. That's a theological, like, you're in heaven. That's like a theological heaven in Genesis 15, 12 through 21. That is just a beautiful theological truth right there. But the reason they skip it in the curriculum is they want you to see this crash to real life. And it's just so vivid. So here we go. So now Sarah, Abram's wife, bare him no children. Now, again, remember God just promised him that, hey, no, it's going to come from you. Your heir is going to come from you. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Do not fear. I'm your shield. I'm your exceeding great reward. Focus on me. Don't focus on me. But Sarah and them, still no children. Still no children. And Sarai said unto Abraham, or Abram, I keep saying Abraham, Abram, all right, behold, now the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid, and it may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. We go from that theological mountaintop. I mean, look, you've got to see the reality of this. I know we want to paint it over like it's a nice little Sunday school lesson for children, but we just got to get very, 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 very blunt here. We go from the theological mountaintop, and then we crash to the reality of life, and there's Abram, I'm going to just be blunt here, having sex with their Egyptian slave. There's no way, you can try to dress this up and make it all nice for church, but it's not supposed to be nice. You're supposed to go, I think this is where you, when you're reading like a novel and you're like, whoa, what just happened here? What just happened? See, we put it way back then and we almost view it like it doesn't count. Like that would never happen today. Like if you knew someone in your church, right? If you knew someone in your church and they had been praying and praying and praying to have a baby, praying and praying and praying to have a baby, praying and praying to have a baby, praying and praying to have a baby. And all of a sudden in your small group or in the Sunday school class, the wife raises her hand and says, I want to let everyone know we're going to have a baby because I gave my husband our housekeeper and he slept with her and she's pregnant. Everybody happy for me? Everybody be like, what? You let your husband sleep with your housekeeper? What is going on? And actually, I think the story is even much more ugly than that. But that's we treat it differently. So what we say is, well, that happened back then. Okay. You have to understand the times. Okay. Well, then if you're going to say that, you've got to be consistent. If you say, well, if you understand the times, okay, well, then if someone in your church now comes out and says, hey, I'm transgender, are you going to condemn it? Because you got to understand the times. How come we understand the time? We have to understand the times when we're reading things in the Old Testament, but we don't have to understand the times in our modern context, right? Can't every generation go, well, if you understood the times, you would see it was no big deal. Is it a big deal or not a big deal? I mean, it's shocking to go from the mountaintop of Genesis 15 to there's Abram, Father Abraham, the hero of the faith, sleeping with their Egyptian slave. At Sarai's suggestion, even after God said, I'm going to take care of the situation, Abram, I'm going to take care of it. And he believed, and it was counted him for righteousness. Well, his belief obviously wasn't, there was a problem here. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. So sleeps with her and gives him to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that he had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. Now, you could argue he gave him to be his wife. Then he slept with her, right? I think that depending on how you want to look at this, because Genesis 16:2 says, and Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. So in other words, he went along with the plan. Then it appears he gave him to be his wife. So then he's practicing polygamy, right? So he practicing polygamy. She becomes his wife. Then he goes in unto her. All right. We can put it in that context. So then I guess we could say he began to practice polygamy. Then he slept with her. All right. And he went unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid unto thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. Now Sarai seems upset about the situation. She comes up with the plan. Abram goes along. Now Sarai is upset with the plan. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. So Abram's like, okay, hey, look, you know, it was your idea. She's your handmaid. Do whatever you want. And she deals harshly with her, and Hagar flees. Like obviously, Abram's like, no, wait, Sarai. She's my wife. She's my wife here. No. He's like, do whatever you want. Abram forgets really quick that it's his wife. He's like, you know, she's just your handmaid. Do whatever you want. Whoa, what a compassionate, godly family this is. Like, what kind of mess is this? Now, it's ugly. It's going to get uglier in a minute. I want you to see what the curriculum does here, right? I want you to see what the curriculum does here. All right? Now, this is, if I go back here to the curriculum, hang on. We are in... Unit 2, Session 5, Confidence After We Fall, or After We Fail, I should say. True God, Trust God to Redeem Your Failures, Genesis 16, 1 through 5, and 17, 1 through 9. Now, if you go to the Adult Personal Study Guide, we read this. I want you to see how they introduce this, and then we're going to look at some things that are going to be a little unpleasant here. All right? So I kind of gave you a little bit of the text. A little bit of the text, and just I kind of mentioned it. I didn't go into great detail because a lot of times I throw something out, and then I hope someone will catch it. Just remember, in that text, you can check a number of English translations to see how they read it. Sarah comes up with the idea, then Abram takes her to be the wife, then he sleeps with her. Would everyone agree that's the correct chronological order? Then Sarah gets upset, and then Abram almost forgets that Hagar's now his wife and says, do whatever you want. Now, I'm just going to throw that out there. Is it possible that some could say he slept with her, then he took him to be his wife? Is that even a possible rendering? I just like to throw these things out there just to see how different translations handle it, right? Not being dogmatic. Remember, this is the introduction. I just throw a lot of things out at you. But here's how the study guide handles it. Question one, when have you seen failure to lead to something positive? Now, immediately, you can tell that the curriculum is going to try to take this story and try to find something positive within it, because it's a very common thing in the modern church that everything has to be positive, everything has to be encouraging, everything has to be upbeat. To me, this story bothers me. This story really, it makes my skin crawl a little bit, okay? And I know you're going to be like, why? It doesn't really bother me. Maybe it doesn't bother men. It would be interesting to see it with women, if women were like having this discussion about this text and there were no men around. If they were very real about how this text makes them feel, it would be interesting. And I think some women, depending on what they've gone through, it'd be very interesting. Okay. So it says the point this week is to trust God to redeem your failures. Trust God to redeem your failures. Now, I do believe that before the week is over, we need to develop a good theology of failure. And I think that's missing. So they would put in their theology of failure, we have to trust God to redeem our failures. Okay. That could come into play. We'll see. Now, this is how they describe it. The Bible meets life. Our team was up 6-2. It was the bottom of the last inning, and the other team had the bases loaded. The pitcher launched a ball straight down the middle and crack. The ball was headed straight for the fence. It was a grand slam homer that ended the game with a tie. I felt the pain of the pitcher as he walked off the mound holding his head low. I was not just his assistant coach. I was his dad. My son actually had a good day on the field, but it didn't matter in his mind. He had failed and his confidence was shattered. Now, I got to stop right here. That story that they start with, so in my estimation, so undermines the severity of what we're reading happening in Genesis 16. They just took a story to get us into the discussion of Genesis 16 about someone who just quote unquote failed in a baseball game, for crying out loud. I mean, of all the stories you could use, of all the illustrations, you're going to use the illustration of someone failed in a baseball game and they didn't even really fail that bad because the game ended in a tie. They didn't even technically lose. That's the story. I can give you a million illustrations of some really horrific and horrible failures. So I just find it interesting that it's like, let's use just maybe it's a good thing. Maybe by using a little failure like this that everyone may see their failure somehow in this story. I don't know. I just find it somewhat interesting. Then it says, we all fail at times. When we make mistakes. Now, I want you to just see this. We're not using the word sin here and so far. We're using failure. We're using mistakes. Failure, mistakes. Now, let's just think this through. So God directly reveals himself to Abram, right? I mean, that's pretty amazing. God speaks directly to Abram. That's pretty amazing. And even though God directly speaks to him and tells him, don't fear, I'm your shield, I'm your exceeding great reward, and I'm going to take care of you not having any children. It's all going to work out. And then the next time you read Abram's having sex with an Egyptian slave, I don't know if that just is a failure or a mistake. Maybe we could call that a sin. Now, I trust me, I know from my own personal sin that I like to refer to it as a failure and a mistake sometimes more than I like to refer to it as a sin. It just takes the edge off a little bit. But my failures were sin. And I don't think we just fail at times. I think we fail all the time. I think if we're going to have a theology of failure, it has to start with an honesty about our failure. I did this morning. Now let me do it again here. The Bible tells you to be holy as God is holy. We fail to live up to that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of every year. You're told to love the Lord thy God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your body, with all your soul. I bet you fell on that all the time. You're told to love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, you're told in other parts of the Bible in Philippians to put others before yourself. You're told to love your enemy. You're told to turn the other cheek. You're told to resist not evil. You're told to forgive others as Christ Jesus has forgiven you. I can just go on and on and on and on, and you fail to live up to that over and over. It's not that we just fail at times. We live in some ways in a perpetual state of failure. But Christians don't want a theology of failure, so we somehow convince ourselves that we're better than we actually are. So that we end up like being the Pharisee saying, I thank God I'm not like all these other people because I'm really such a good guy. Or I'm such a good female, gal, whatever term you want to use. So they already are really trying to, you fail sometimes. When we make mistakes, it's so easy for us to beat ourselves up. Now, don't feel too bad. Whether our tongue gets the best of us, we drop the ball at work, or we run back to an old addiction. Our sins, praise God, they use the word sins there, and failures can completely crush our confidence. When that happens, how do we pull ourselves out of the dugout and get our heads back into the game of life? Let's take some coaching tips from the life of Abram. Now, again, it's just like, hey, if you mess up, you got to get, how do you get back into the game? You don't want it to destroy your confidence. I just think that so undermines the severity of what we've just looked at in Genesis 16. But I do appreciate what they are about to do in the curriculum. Here we go. This account of Abram's life is one of failure and of getting ahead of God. Abram's failure in this account involved three individuals. Number one, Sarai. It had been 10 years since God had promised that Sarai would bear Abram a son. It would surely not be surprising to know she had been becoming increasingly embarrassed and frustrated by her barrenness. Little did she know, however, that she would have to hold out for another 15 years until God would deliver on his promise with the birth of her son, Isaac. But at this point, her patience had run out. Oh, let me stop right here. We have the failure, the sin of Sarai. And here's the sin and here's the failure. I think that there's a little bit of this. And I know that we have to kind of play, couch psychologist here. So I don't want to be dogmatic about it. But if it's true that Sarai is more worried about how she looks, that she's embarrassed because, other women are having children and she's not, and she's frustrated, that means she seems more focused on herself than on God's plan, God's glory, God's purpose. Now, is it a situation where she just wanted God's purpose to be fulfilled? Well, if it was just a purpose of wanting God's purpose to be fulfilled, and that's all she was worried about, she would leave it up to God. Hey, God, it's your purpose. You fulfill it whenever you want. I'm here whenever you're ready. But if all of a sudden you have a personal investment and it's about you, your pride, your arrogance, how you're viewed, you don't want other people looking down on you, then it stops becoming about God and it becomes about you. And whenever it becomes about us and not about God, we are in trouble. We are in trouble. Now, I'll speak to myself here because I don't want to be too harsh on Sarai. Remember, I always try to say we always have to look to ourselves. I'll look in the mirror. Okay, I sit here in this empty building hour after hour after hour after hour behind this microphone doing as much teaching as I can. And I'll be honest with you. I go back and I try to listen to things at different times, not because I think it's wonderful, because I try to learn from my mistakes. And a lot of times I will listen to something and I'm embarrassed by the fact that I posted that on the internet. I'm embarrassed by it. It's embarrassing because I want people to think that I'm the best teacher. I want people to think that I'm a great teacher. I want people to have positive things to say about me. I want people to praise my programs and my episodes. I do. I want large numbers. And as soon as I realize I want all of that, I realize, I'm making it about me. It shouldn't be about me. It should be about God. When I preach, it shouldn't be, I want everyone to tell me how great a sermon it is. What I want is that it did what it's supposed to do, and I equip saints for the work of ministry. I equip them so they'll no longer be tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. What do I want to accomplish? Sometimes I want to delete things that are on the internet because they make me look bad. And I'm like, you know what? I could redo that one again. No one would notice. It'll just be gone from the archive. I'll do the same teaching. I will improve it. I will correct my mistakes. I'll make sure I didn't mispronounce that word or I stumbled over that. And then I'll look really, 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 really smart. But you see, I'm making it about me. How often do you make things about you? Theology of failure includes what causes us to fail. And sometimes what causes us to fail is when we become more preoccupied with us and our how we feel, how we look, than how God looks. We should always be focused on glorifying God, not glorifying self. So I've learned to try to leave things that sometimes make me look stupid, simply not because I'm spiritual, not because I'm godly, but because I know how unspiritual and ungodly I am. And so it serves as a knife into the heart because I know I look stupid and it's on the internet for everyone to hear. It is embarrassing. And I just leave the knife there because I have to, it has to be used to kill me. And when I say kill me, not a physical death, but killing me in an illustrative, metaphorical way. I just think it's interesting that it says that she became embarrassed and frustrated by her barrenness. Sarai was making it about her. So she took matters into her own hands. Our 21st century Western minds might be shocked by Sarai's proposal. We see her suggestion as outright disobedience and the encouragement of adultery. But her heart was truly in the right place. She wanted to assist God with his plan, and the surrounding culture would not have thought twice about it. It was common in the ancient Near East for men to sire children through the other wives or female servants. Now, let's stop right here. First, they say that she was embarrassed and frustrated. Well, was she embarrassed and frustrated because God's plan wasn't being accomplished, or was she embarrassed and frustrated because she was a woman who had not bore any children in a culture that probably seen that as like, if you don't do that, what's your purpose? But then they say, her heart was in the right place. She was trying to help God's plan. Was she trying to help God's plan, or was she trying to help her reputation? What was she really doing here? What was she really doing? It's funny, like on one hand, we're going to try to make her look bad and the other we're not. But then I love what the curriculum does. But I know it's shocking to us, but you got to consider the time. Well, we got to be careful with saying that. Well, you know what? At that time, it was common. Well, at our time, it is common for people to be in same-sex relationships. So it's common for, you know what I'm saying? Like, look at all the things that are common in 2021. Are we going to say, well, so if someone does it, they shouldn't really, you know, it's no big deal. No, for the Christian, our morality is not determined as, we don't determine the severity of our sin based off what is common in culture, okay? We base the severity of sin, is it against what God calls us to do and how to live? Now, we can get into a big debate about Genesis and do we judge these people in Genesis according to God's law, which had not been revealed yet? Or do we, I mean, like, there are some serious questions about how we do that. And I understand that. But I'm saying that what happens here is, yeah, okay. God had said to Abraham, God had said Abram would be the father of a great nation, but he had not specified who the mother would be. So Sarai responded she would step out of the way so the promise could be fulfilled. Besides, since Hagar was Sarai's servant, Hagar's children could be considered Sarai's children. So again, it's kind of a mixed bag. Sarai was worried about herself. No. She was worried about God's plan. So I guess you can spin it to make it look like that Sarai was good. Yes, very good. Heather just said, also, our morality is not based on our heart. Status, meaning our heart status, meaning well, doesn't cut it. That's so true. But I just, to be fair, I want to make sure, because I didn't really articulate the thought clearly. Just remember, there is some debate that do we judge these actions in Genesis according to the law that had not yet been given? Or do we view these actions as occurring before the law and therefore they cannot be judged by it? All right. So, meaning well does not cut it. So I do agree. Her how well-meaning she was, it doesn't matter. All right. I mean, you know, some guy could say, you know, I meant well. I mean, I thought that the stripper, you know, she needed some extra money. And I mean, she's a single mom and I meant well. I mean, I went to the strip club to try to, you know, help support her only child. I mean, I meant well. I don't think most wives would be like, you know, honey, you probably did mean well. And considering it's 2021, going to the strip club is really not considered taboo anymore. So, you know, it's perfectly okay. It's perfectly okay. And the only reason I mention an illustration of a strip club is because everything that happened here in Texas with the Travis Scott concert and what, 9 people dying. After that concert, Drake was one of the rappers who appeared, and Drake, after the show, went to a strip club where they dropped, are you ready for this? $1 million. There are photos from the strip club, and there's stacks and stacks of money all over the floor. It's just $1 million in a strip club. You talk about those strippers getting paid that evening. I mean, wow. Hey, Drake, could you just stop by here in the middle of nowhere, Texas, and just pay off my house payment? That's all I want. But yeah, so that's the reason that illustration came to my mind. So people go like, wait, has he been hanging out at the strip club? I just want you to know that meaning well doesn't cut it. And I agree. Whether she meant well, I mean, there's a lot of things we could say about what Sarai's motivation is. I don't know. I mean, we could have a long discussion here. And I hate doing that to historical characters because we can't read their minds. But was she doing this because, oh, I'm so worried about God's plan. I'm so worried that God can't fulfill his plan. Okay, Abram, we got to help God out. Was it that, or was she like, hey, I'm looking really bad here. I'm a woman and I haven't produced any children. And that's like not a good thing in our culture. Which was it? I don't know. Either way, she conducts this crazy plan. All right. Now, so there's Sarai. Second person involved in this story is Abram. Even if we think Sarai made a poor judgment call, let's not lay all the blame on her. After all, Abram went along with the plan. He could have said no, but Sarai's reasoning apparently made perfect sense to Abram. Now, this again, Christianize this. Sometimes I think, if you've ever seen a Disney show, a Disney movie, I don't care, High School Musical, any of the Disney shows, Disney movies, I always joke that Disney always takes life and makes it look as, you know, as nice and as clean as it can be, but it's not reality, right? High school is not like it is in a Disney movie. Family life is not like it is in a Disney show. I think it's a little funny that they're going to describe Abram as like, well, hey, Sarai, that's a very good plan. You know, I do believe that we need to help God out. You are such spiritual insight, Sarai. I'm so thankful God gave me you because you are just you have such great spiritual insight. Thank you so very much. Let me go help God out. That so spiritualizes this to it almost becoming foolish. Can we just be blunt? Abram's a man. And he's just given the opportunity to go sleep with another woman at his wife's blessing. There's not a lot of men, I don't care, and I know people don't like when I get blunt, but there's not a lot of even so-called godly men be like, you know, honey, I don't think I should do this. There's many Christian men who would be like, oh, thank you. I think you're right. Now, we can spiritualize it. The point of this way, the text doesn't say what Abram was thinking, okay? I just know he doesn't say anything other than he goes along with the plan. The next time he speaks is like, oh, well, you're upset with her. Well, you go take care of her. Like there's nothing reported here. So it's very hard to read his mind, but I think we have to at least open the door for the possibility that he was like, okay, I get to fulfill the desires of the flesh. And he does. And then this is where the story, this is the part that I really get upset about. Here we go. Hagar, the third person involved in this story, is Hagar. Hagar was an Egyptian maidservant, likely acquired during Abram and Sarai's brief journey into Egypt in Genesis chapter 12, verses 10 through 20. Sarai used Hagar for her benefit, almost like a modern-day surrogate. Because of her position as a servant, Hagar had no choice but to go along with the plan. As a result, she got pregnant. Now, whenever you read the words, "she had no choice" and "she got pregnant," whenever you see the words "she had no choice" and "Abram went in unto her," to call it rape, I think, is not only justified, it's probably the most accurate way of understanding what occurred. She had no say-so in the plan. Her wishes did not matter. She was a slave, and she was used for Sarai's benefit. This is horrific. Horrific. It bothers me so much. Now, atheists and agnostics will be the first to point at, your wonderful Abraham was basically a rapist. And Christians will be like, no. We can't call it that. That's probably not true. Probably Hagar wanted to go along with it. Maybe she did. I will grant you a slight possibility. But considering she was a slave, I doubt they even asked her opinion. Now, she may have felt doing this could put me and the good graces of my owners, okay? But I mean, it's not, that's just horrible to even imagine. Let me read this. So even the adult personal study guide, who tries to look at things in a very positive way, says, because of her position as a servant, Hagar had no choice but to go along with the plan. As a result, she got pregnant. Sarai's plan seemed to be working, but then the situation got ugly. It got ugly when they decided to use another woman to make Sarai look better, or to use another woman without her choice to supposedly fulfill God's plan. As Hagar's stomach grew with her baby, her confidence also increased, and as she interacted with Sarai. In Mesopotamian culture, a maidservant or a second wife who provided an heir could be deemed equal with the first wife. She could be given her freedom, gain an inheritance, or both. The passage only refers to Hagar's contempt for Sarai, but Hagar could have been using this situation as an opportunity to advance. Sarai took Hagar's behavior as both disrespectful and threatening. The tension and animosity between the two women escalated to the point that Sarai, in a sense, flew off at the handle at Abram, "My wrong be upon thee." It's as if Sarah forgot her own role in this, and she called on God to judge between the two of them. That's just, hey, God needs to judge between the two of us. What? My wrong is on you. It's your fault, buddy. And you're like, whoa. It just demonstrates that even people who hear directly from God, they're just still sinners. Because I don't care how much you hear from God internally, you are still a sinner, which we talked a little bit about this morning, about the reality of internal depravity. His statement, "Behold, thy maid is in thine hand," was to remind Sarah that she was still the wife and had the primary role. But wait a minute. If Hagar had become his wife, I still think that, to me, this seems like a cop-out from Abram. Hey, just remember, she's your handmaid, all right? Just remember, you're the wife, she's the handmaid. Well, wait, but you used her as a wife, right? But that's okay, we're going to forget about that. Abram added, "Do to her as it pleaseth thee." Unfortunately, Sarai's abused her position and threatened and treated Hagar so horribly she fled. Now, the text doesn't say what she did to her. The text does not say what she did to her. I don't know what she did. But just try to, there is no way to get around this. basically you have a slave. You cannot say that this is not not highly probable. She was raped. And then she's abused, treated horribly, and has to flee. Hagar, nobody cares about. I mean, everybody just almost throws her to the side. But Abram is celebrated as a great man of faith. This is ugly. This is horrific. This should bother you all day, every day. And here's what drives me crazy. We treat this as like some weird anomaly. Like, you know, oh, wow. You know, this happened way back then. Could never, we don't have a theology of failure that takes these horrible things that we read in the Bible and actually able to deal with them in the present. But I would just challenge you, you know, just every day, check the Roy's report. Julie Roy's, the Roy's report. She's always reporting on the horrible things going on in the church. And it's everything from rape, lawsuits, sexual assault, sexual misconduct. Every day it's just some horrible story of something else happening in some church. It is horrible, 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 horrible. Now, whenever it happens, people are just like, they're not even Christians. I don't know what's going on. They're ungodly. Read everything supposedly Ravi Zacharias did. That is some messed up stuff. And so now people are like, well, you know, he probably wasn't even saved, and just move on. We have to understand that failure, not only is it possible within the Christian life, it is the norm. We are sinners, we have a sinful nature, and we fall short of God's standard in thought, in word, and in deed. We fall short continually. The only reason Abram can be considered anything but a horrific human being is because of the imputed righteousness that he received by faith in Genesis chapter 15, verse 6. The only way he can be considered righteous, the only reason he can be considered just, is because of an imputed righteousness, not because of his life. Not because, and trust me, just because he offered up his only son as a sacrifice doesn't make up for being a polygamist, a rapist, and a coward that put his own wife in danger when he realized that he could be going into an area and they would think that, ooh, he's got a pretty wife. Let me get rid of him. No, there's no way. One good doesn't make up for your bad. That's not the way it works. Not all of the good that I may have ever done in my life cannot make up for all the bad that I've done in my life. And I've done plenty of bad and wrong. My only hope is an imputed righteousness. A theology of failure has to acknowledge failure happens all the time. We have to acknowledge that we have a tendency to just focus on self and not on God or anything else and elevate self to get what we want and to make ourselves look good. We have to realize that that's what we're prone to do. And we have to see that failure is a real failure. We have to acknowledge it. We have to see it. There's a horrible story here. I know that earlier in my Christian life, I just kind of like, okay, you know, in my brain, the way I've always pictured it is, okay, well, Hagar probably went along with the idea. She probably helped come up with the idea. And, you know, it's kind of sad that everything got, you know, she got treated so badly, but you know, I just kind of downplayed it. But the longer I've been a Christian, the more I realize I don't think there's any way to make this look nice. I know we have to try to make it look nice for church, but why do we have to make it look nice for church? It's almost like, well, we don't want our kids to think that Father Abraham was a bad guy. I mean, Father Abraham. I mean we got to sing that song during Sunday school. I mean, I understand you don't walk into, you know, you don't walk into the first grade class. I want everyone to know that I understand there's a time and place. Trust me, I understand. But there comes a time that they have to realize as soon as they can that the people in the Bible were sinners, just like their mom and dad, just like their pastor, and just like everyone around them, and just like them. The more everyone can just be open and honest about our depravity and our failures, I think the better off we are spiritually. But as long as we want to cover it in a robe of self-righteousness, we never get anywhere. So here's what I want you to do this week. It's going to be a simple assignment. All right. It's going to be a simple assignment. And we're going to come back to this. This week, I don't know what day it was. I subscribe to a bazillion different podcasts. And one of the podcasts I subscribe to is basically the chapel service for a Bible college. I don't even know where the Bible college is located. I think it's called Ambassador Bible College. I don't even know where it is. Maybe it's Ambassador Baptist Bible College. I don't even know. And, you know, I'm just going through my podcast apps, play, you know, news, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden I look and I'm like, whoa, wait. It's like three lessons about failure. And I'm like, whoa, that looks pretty good. Now, I don't necessarily agree with everything, how they approached it, but I think that they're on to something with how they handled it. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to look up Proverbs 24:16 this week. Proverbs 24:16. And I want you to just think about Proverbs 24:16. And I want you to see how many principles that you think you can find in Proverbs 24:16 in regards to failure and to sin, and how this could be critical in developing a theology of failure. Let me read it to you. Proverbs 24:16, "For a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him." All right. Now, I'm going to give you, they just focused on 16, but I want you to look at Proverbs 24:16 through 18. I want you to just live with Proverbs 24:16 through 18 this week. I want you to live with it. And what I want you to just try to like outline it with principles about failure, principles about a theology of failure and a theology of sin. I want you to see what you can derive from Proverbs 24:16 through 18, and you can see how any of that may relate to Genesis 16. But I just, Proverbs 24:16 through 18, I want you to just live with it. I've got my own notes here that I started writing out. I took some from the chapel. It was basically a message from chapel at that Bible college. And I've got four right now. I've got four. I kind of added beyond what they had, and I changed some of what they had. I kind of did a lot of my own work here, but at some point this week, we will look at it. But I want you to live with it, and I want you to live with it. Now, please know this. I will not be here Monday or Tuesday, right? Because right now at my house, there's all kinds of people. Because of everyone's schedule, my family is having our holiday, as my daughter calls it, the holiday extravaganza. And I've been given a limited amount of time to be here this afternoon. And now I have to go home because it's literally, you think I'm joking. My daughter's written an entire itinerary of every minute of every day, what we're going to be doing, whether we're going to be taking photos. That's what we're doing this evening at 5:20. And then we're going to do a murder mystery game with everyone. And I don't know how we're doing that. We've got, I don't know all the details. I don't know. It's just an itinerary of everything. So every minute of my life has now been determined by my daughter. So she just flew in from Boston, and my sister's daughter is with us. Just all kinds of stuff is going on. So that means Monday and Tuesday is out of the picture. They have on the itinerary given me time to come back Wednesday afternoon. So I do get to come back Wednesday afternoon. So I will not be here Monday and Tuesday. That's going to be hard for me. Okay. But I'm going to enjoy the time, even though I'm going to feel bad that I'm not providing you anything. But what I want you to do is that at any time this week, as you're studying Proverbs 24 and you're looking at verses 14 through 16, or Proverbs 16, I'm not 14 through 16. Hang on, let me go back and look because I don't want to give you the wrong reference after I've given you the correct reference, because then I'll hear this and then want to come all the way back to the church to fix it. Proverbs 24, 16 through 18, Proverbs 24, 16 through 18. I want you to look at it, look at it, look at it. Send me your outline of it. Send me the principles you derive from it. Send them to me Monday and Tuesday, because even though I'm not here, obviously there'll be some time that I'll be checking my, you know, email, and I'll at least get to see that you are participating. If I don't email you back immediately, understand why, but I'll probably at least send a quick email going like, thumbs up, great job, wonderful, awesome, awesome, awesome. Obviously, for those in the Swell Theology Central group, you can record a swell and just say, oh, I found this or I discovered this, if you want to do that. That's perfectly fine as well. But that's what I want us to do this week. It's a horrible story. It's a horrible story. And I think there's really no way to get around it. It's failure. I don't think there's any way to get around it. I mean, I'm just going to call it failure. I don't know if we can judge it completely in light of the law of Moses. There's a lot of dispute about how to handle that. And I know that there's a big theological issue there. But put it this way. Not only is it a failure, I guess what bothers me the most is that if someone did things like this in the modern church, now obviously in the modern church, some people should be going to jail. So clearly there's some laws being broken and they would have to be turned in legally. I absolutely agree. But we would just immediately, we would be done with the people. We would just like cast them off. But wait a minute. So if someone does it in the modern context, absolutely the law should be contacted because law is being broken. Absolutely. Someone should go to jail. But we would just discount their Christianity. Why? Now, I'm not saying we should excuse their sin. There should be legal actions taken. There should be confrontation. There should be hopefully rebuke. Then there should be restoration. But in a modern context, nobody would even want to restore the person. Or we would want to restore them to a, like, you're always going to be at a lesser level as a Christian. But Abram gets restored. Not only does he get restored, he goes from Abram to Abraham, and God still fulfills his promise to him, and Abram becomes so important that he's listed in the great heroes of the faith chapter in Hebrews chapter 11. And his sin is not mentioned. We always forget his sin. We don't talk about his sin. Now, his sin's been forgiven. So in that sense, we shouldn't. We just kind of see this as a little, well, you know, we kind of made a little mistake. Why do we play it down so much? Because modern day Christianity doesn't ever seem to have the ability to deal with failure. We have to minimize it because we've so bought into the idea that when we become Christians, we now become almost perfect, which is just not the case. And again, you can hear our discussion during the Sunday school hour this morning where we looked at the news article where they've done this study demonstrating that religious people really aren't any more moral than their non-religious counterparts, which is kind of convicting and embarrassing if you think about it. All right, we're at 1 hour and 7 minutes into this, and I know I need to stop. I hope it was an interesting conversation. I hope it was an interesting discussion. There's much for you to think about there. But we really just, before the week is over, we'll really want to just try to formulate a good theology of failure, that we really have all the basic elements of it. We have, because we need some really, 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 really good elements, all right? That's the play. Thank you, Heather. I'm gonna try to have as much fun as I can with not being able to do this, because I love doing this as well. But yeah, I'm going to make time. Because to be fair, one of my great failures is, especially back when I had another podcast that used to have over 30,000 listeners per month, and that was a big thing at that time. I was full-time in the military, full-time basically as a pastor, and basically a full-time podcaster. So I was working, and I know this is going to sound like I'm exaggerating, but well over 80 hours a week, probably close to 100 hours a week, never was sleeping, and I basically messed over my family. So, yeah, they definitely deserve me setting aside this for them because I definitely messed up big time. So, yeah, one of my many failures that we could talk about. But yeah, the whole point is I'm just a sinner with behind a microphone. I'm just like you. But thank God for an imputed righteousness, because man, without it, not only would I be going to hell, I deserve to already be in hell. And with that, and other than the imputed righteousness, I mean, in myself, I still deserve to be in hell right now, but imputed righteousness is my only hope. And I cannot stress that enough. All right. Thanks for listening. Everyone have a great day. I'll probably be back on the air. I'm going to try to get at least one more thing done. I think I have time, maybe. Yes, I have time. I just have to leave by 5 because we're doing pictures this evening. So that's what we're going to do. All right. So we're going to finish that up, and then I'll see what I can do and hopefully produce something else that will be beneficial for you for Monday and Tuesday. All right. Everyone, thanks for listening. Thank you, as always, Heather, for your support and for listening. Everyone have a great day. God bless.